We're speaking now with Sage Dixon. He is the incumbent representative in House Seat B here in District 1. Sage, thank you for taking time to talk with us.
Absolutely, Chris. It's great to be face-to-face finally.
Yeah.
Once again, I should say.
Not only you being down in Boise a lot, but also just the whole pandemic thing.
Right.
Put the kibosh on a lot of face-to-face. Right. Well, let's start out. You've been our incumbent representative for 8 years now, but tell us a bit about your background for folks that may not know you. Introduce yourself to the voters.
Okay. Well, my name is Sage Dixon. I'm married. I have 7 children. 3 of those children are still in the home. Most of them are out now at this point, but my wife and I live about 20 minutes north of Sandpoint on a small piece of acreage up there. We've been married 27 years, and we've been up here in this area for just about 20 years now. I was a small business owner prior to getting into this elected position. Once I was elected, I found it difficult. I was an electrical contractor, so it was difficult to commit to jobs because I was traveling back and forth to Boise after my first term, and I got into the insurance business after that. So mainly small business experience in doing that. I had an interest in bringing conservative representation to the district. I didn't think what was going on when I first ran was what this district wanted, and evidently folks agreed enough to elect me at that point 8 years ago and have continued to reelect me going forward. I'm still representing those values and doing the best I can for this district and listening to what people want and responding to the needs of the district as well.
Mm-hmm. And in the House, what committees do you sit on?
I've had a multitude of committees. Well, not a multitude. I've been on the business committee and the transportation committee for all 8 years of my service. I started off on the education committee. After that first term, I was moved to our budget committee, which is called JFAC, the Joint Finance and Appropriation Committee. And then for the past 4 years, I've served on revenue and taxation in doing that. And presently, I chair the business committee, which I have chaired for the past 4 years as well. So that's another nuance. I also serve on the Committee on Federalism. I am the House chair for that committee, which just meets whenever the chairman calls a meeting. And then I am also the chairman of the Ethics Committee, which is selected by the majority caucus within the House.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, let's get to a question I ask all the candidates. Why, Sage Dixon, are you running for re-election?
I'm running. I still want to represent this district. And it's funny, Chris. I've thought about this over the years about the stereotypical, well, it's a career, you're being a career politician. But when you serve for more than a term, you start to see things that need to be improved. Or you have your ideas that you've taken down there. And there's not generally a quick fix on big ideas, be it taxation or education policy. And it takes time to work through a lot of larger issues. So thankfully, I've been able to do that in my service now. But there's still things I would like to correct, be it internally with our processes to make sure that government is able to represent everybody accurately and no manipulation, or issues like I'm sure we'll talk about property taxes. That has come to the forefront, and trying to work through that as we've done it these past few years, but now having a different approach in moving forward. So I still think there's things I can do to benefit this district and the state in general.
The legislature is typically in session from about January through March or into April. That can vary year to year, but you're representing constituents year round. And the question I'm asking candidates for the legislature is, if elected, how much time will you devote to your office on a weekly basis? In your case, it would be, how much time do you devote?
It can be quite a bit, and especially these past 2 years, it's been quite different than the previous years with COVID and all the concerns surrounding the pandemic from business owners and individuals and coming in. There's usually, if there's a hot topic nationally, we start to get emails on that also and things. And a lot of the communication comes through email. I much prefer face-to-face communication. I will suggest we go out to coffee, especially if somebody's mad about something they think I've done, that we can sit down and talk to it. So I don't have necessarily a defined amount of time that I devote to it. As it comes in, I try and take care of it. Sometimes if it's just a form letter, then that doesn't get a lot of attention. When we get up to 100 a day sometimes of everything saying the same thing, just a different name at the top.
Some political group is pushing it up.
Correct, and people just go online and click add me, and then it self-populates and off it runs. But I try to make time to talk to constituents as best I can, have meetings with local groups here within the district to see what's going on, working right now with Alta Mill in Naples to try and improve their transportation situation as they grow. We've done a lot of work in Priest Lake and then here at Lakeshore in 95. So as those things come up and as people bring me ideas, then I devote more time to them and trying to chase things down with state government agencies or with the local folks here and trying to solve those problems.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned Naples. It's interesting. A lot of folks probably lose sight of the fact that District 1 covers all of Boundary County to our north.
Right.
How do you stay in touch with those constituents?
Oh, we have a lot of friends up there. We used to go to church up there and homeschool with groups up there. So we're very tied into that community. A lot to do with the ag community and the timber community up there as well. And so it's not hard for me.
Mm-hmm. Okay, on to the issues. What do you consider to be the biggest issues in the House race that you would like voters to be considering when they're weighing out who they're going to vote for?
I think property taxes are one of the biggest issues, and that's come up quite a bit. Some of the stuff gets a little wonky. I think in the race itself, there's not maybe great dissimilarities, if that's a correct word, or differences between the gentleman and I as far as principle goes, but it has to go with approach. The way I've tried to approach things is diplomatically and talking to my colleagues, as many as possible, and trying to establish relationships. And there's another approach to legislation, which is berating people and being aggressive and trying to gain popular support on the outside to pressure people on the inside. And I don't think that that's worked very well. I think I've seen success in building relationships with folks in my party and not in my party, and in the Senate and then governor's office, because that's what it takes really to get some change through. You've got to have buy-in from those other entities, not just your group of friends here in doing that. So some of it, I think, is just approach, Chris, and how we're looking at these things, but definitely taxes. What's come up is my voting record. I'm not as pure, perhaps, a conservative as some people want me to be by a standard that is out there in the state. And I think that's an arbitrary standard, and that they don't know everything that happens, meaning that sitting in a committee, you hear the full argument from both sides, people for and against. If you just read the title of a bill and then maybe the explanation of it, you don't really know what that argument is. You can glean a little bit, but some of their decisions are not based on hearing all the facts as far as this group that scores different bills. But that's just they're going off a surface understanding. So that's brought up as far as my voting record is suspect.
Well, let's dig in on that one just a little bit more. So property tax relief has been an issue that the legislature seems to have talked about quite a bit. And in fact, there was one proposal to almost eliminate it and in favor of a sales tax, increasing the sales tax, essentially. So what do you see as some solutions to, you know, property taxes going up? And we're seeing it particularly now that property values are escalating.
Right. Yeah. I was excited about that proposal because I do think we should not have to pay a property tax. I think we should own our property and then be able to flourish with that and self-determination that goes along with owning property and how it was tied to the liberties that were being upheld at the founding of our country and doing that. Got a lot of pushback from local businesses when we talked about raising the sales tax by 2% to cover that. The state sets property tax policy, but we don't receive any of that revenue. It's all locals, the counties and the cities that do that. So it's an odd relationship. Some of the counties weren't very happy with it either. They were concerned, excuse me, they wouldn't be getting enough revenue in doing that. We've had an interim committee, so a committee that meets outside of our normal session, studying property tax for the past 2 years. Their first attempt was to control the budgets of the local entities, and that didn't go over very well. It was a lot of the southern Idaho folks that thought they had a larger problem with that. Up here, Bonner County's been doing great. Boundary County's been doing great. So we didn't see the problems that they saw. But with the majority of the legislature being from the southern end of the state, that's kind of what we ended up with. And we're struggling up here now. Our county levy went up. I know Ponderay's having a hard time because of all the growth they're experiencing. They're capped getting that new construction, which they normally could. Mm-hmm. So I don't think that was a good solution. Long term, it may help with property taxes, but we needed something more definitive that would go right to the property tax owner. Everybody talks about Prop 13 in California, mm-hmm. and that makes sense.
Which basically caps the rate that what property taxes can increase.
Correct. So you buy your home back in, say, 90, and it was $150,000, and either that assessment would hold at that level or whatever the property tax you were paying at that point mm-hmm. is held in perpetuity. So you know what to expect going forward. If you're going to be living there for the rest of your life, you don't feel the pressure of increasing taxes on a fixed income.
And then that property, if it does change hands, that's when it gets adjusted back up.
Correct. And so I come in here in 2020 and purchase right next to you, but I'm paying $400,000, let's say, in our current market, and I would be paying taxes commensurate with that amount, even though you're right next to me. Now, our Constitution does not allow that. It's explicit that like parcels have to be taxed similarly. So the first thing we need to do is change that, to allow the legislature to look at that more deeply, because right now people don't even want to investigate it because we can't do it. I think we need to have a constitutional amendment to allow that. I think that's just, especially as people get older and want to stay on their property, and it's family property, it's been for generations, so there's not that threat of losing it. That's why I was excited about the proposition that came late in the session. So I think that stimulated a lot of interest. We're going to be looking at that. I want to look at that specifically to try and get away from property taxes. We'll have to work through how that works to keep people whole that don't own property. And that was part of that proposal. We would have taken some of the increase in sales tax and then increased the grocery tax credit for those folks. So they would then get some benefit out of that as well. But it's going to be a large conversation, Chris. But I think we really need to look at that strongly going forward, is eliminating that property tax or holding it at a certain level.
Well, you mentioned the grocery tax.
Third rail.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about that. There's been movement in the legislature for years, and it seems to have gained a little more momentum, at least, to eliminate the tax on groceries, right, on the philosophy that, you know, people shouldn't have to pay a tax on food. But the argument against that is that, well, if we can give a tax credit to the residents, then non-residents end up contributing to the state revenues. So where are you at on that?
I think we should eliminate it. It's not a very hot topic in the legislature. Somebody or a group of legislators started marketing it again this year. I will say back in 2017, a couple senators took a bill and they radiator capped it. And what that means is if it went over House Bill number 1 to the Senate and it was about, let's say, property tax, then they took that bill, kept it with the title of House Bill 1, but then made it a bill on removing the sales tax on groceries. Totally different, but you basically pull up the radiator cap and drive a new car in and do that is the term that we use. That got out of the Senate, came back to the House, we passed it in the House, and then the governor vetoed it. It was Governor Otter at that point in time. It came up again in 2019 in the committee in the House, and I voted for that at that point as well, but it didn't pass out of the committee. So since then, there's been some talking, but it wasn't ever a large topic with legislation being pushed until this year when it became marketed pretty hard to the citizens of Idaho in doing that. And everybody wants to pay less taxes. And then you think exactly as you said, food is a basic staple of life. We shouldn't be taxed on that. So I'm in favor of doing that. That is the argument, which you already described, is that we are having folks that come in, our large tourism industry, and are paying for the services they use while they're here by collecting that grocery tax on them, and thereby giving a credit. With the size of my family, that credit didn't cover really what we were paying, and not everybody has a family as large as I do, but in the southern part of the state, there was as well. So that was a little bit of the difficulty, plus the thought that the government is holding on to your dollars and then doling them back out to you at the end of the year isn't pleasant at some points either. In the southern part of the state, that's the only tax many pay within the agriculture industry and your migrant workers coming in. So a lot of them feel strongly that that's the only tax that people pay. So that's been some of the resistance that I've seen. We didn't have a bill come through the House this year or the Senate. Some things were tried on the floor of the House to pull what's called a personal bill, and those are generally used just to get information out there. It's not actual legislation, and since I've been in, I've understood that, and most legislators understand that. But there were some activities to try and have a personal bill pulled out of a committee and voted on, but that would have meant that we're voting on legislation that didn't have the vetting of a committee or any public input. And so that came up multiple times and was voted down multiple times because of that reason. So I'm hopeful that it'll come through. We'll have a new chairman of the Revenue and Taxation Committee in the House. The former chairman retired. Maybe he'll be or she will be a little more amenable to hearing that bill, but I think that conversation will come up again in the next session.
Okay, on to other issues. One that I'd like to ask about is we had a record budget surplus of nearly $2 billion this year due to a lot higher sales tax receipts, Plus there was money from ARPA, which might be in a separate bucket, I'm not sure, but the legislature returned a good chunk of that back to the taxpayers with a $600 million income tax cut and rebate package. How did you stand on that, yay or nay?
Yay. I thought that was a really good idea. If the taxpayers are paying more and we have that type of a surplus, it should be returned to the taxpayers. And since I've been serving, there's been a push to try and get us down to a flat tax similar to what Utah has. And we've been slowly working in that area, lowering the top rates and increasing the bottom of the lower rates so fewer people are paying taxes. Just about everybody that makes over $10,000 annually is paying the top rate anyway. So it's kind of an odd structure that we have. But giving that rebate is great. Mm-hmm. And then also lowering that top rate again in doing that, I think, is wise policy.
Mm-hmm. Okay. How about other things the legislature did this year to allocate that surplus, right, including infrastructure investments?
Right, and that to me is what is critical, is paying for things now that we may have to pay for in the future, so tangible, long-lasting investments into infrastructure and doing that. The roads, imperative, even though we've put a lot of money in roads over the years, and District 1 has seen a lot of that. There's still a lot of need, and especially with bridges, it's something that I've heard about every year, this backlog of up to $250 million of bridges and other road infrastructure maintenance that is starting, it has a 50-year shelf life, and they're starting to deteriorate now. And there's quite a few in our district, a lot up in Boundary County, but here in Bonner as well. So that was a good investment, I think, to do that. And then into schooling, rural districts have a lot of difficulty with facilities and building maintenance. And so my suggestion to the governor's staff a couple times was, if we're going to put a lot of these dollars into education, let's make it tangible, long-lasting, as I said, and start to help with some of that deferred maintenance and facility needs that we have. That wasn't explicit. Dollars did go into education because there's needs there. And I have felt that in this ongoing battle of education funding, when we do have a surplus, then it's appropriate to put it in that area to try and help mitigate that argument. So a lot of dollars did flow into that. Mm-hmm. ARPA is different. There were extra dollars that came with the ARPA offering as well. And those were other projects that we had done. But with that surplus, I think it was wise to put it into the infrastructure. Mm-hmm.
One thing that the surplus went to, I believe, was education. And as you mentioned, but part of that was all-day kindergarten funding, and that was approved. Were you in favor of that?
Right. I'm not in favor of all-day kindergarten. I think the way this
it was elective. I mean, parents can choose to have their kids in that or not.
Right, but I think it's leading us in that direction. And in my political philosophy and economy, when I'm looking long-term, the more the government is involved in people's lives, the more people are going to look to government for a solution instead of something else, and then government continues to grow. And so if younger and younger children are being into a government system, then I think that is going to become more of a focus of their life in the future and not being autonomous in that sense. I know a lot of what we've done here at Lake Pend Oreille School District has been to help increase reading scores, because that's a critical metric as far as future success goes, from what we've heard in the legislature. And I think the metrics I've been exposed to have proven that as well, that wanting to get children reading at that third grade level. It's not explicit. People, mm-hmm. of course, can do things outside of that. But for the bulk of students to be reading at a third grade level in third grade is somewhat of a measure of a successful future. And if you're not, then it becomes more difficult in doing that. So I agree with front-loading some of our education dollars there to make sure we're doing that for our children. And full-day kindergarten, that option has helped. And Lake Pend Oreille has made use of some of those early reading initiative dollars to do that. But as a whole, if we were going to be doing all-day kindergarten and then going into preschool funded by the state as well, I'm not in favor of those things.
Mm-hmm. As a mandatory
thing. Correct.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. What other issues would you like to call to voters' attention?
That property tax one is a big one that's looming in my mind. I'm hopeful. I don't know where, if I get reelected, this is going to be a big change this year. We'll have half the legislature really turning over, which then means new chairman, new leadership, and I don't know where I'll be in this, whether I'll still be on the Revenue and Taxation Committee and doing that, but I certainly want to be part of that conversation in doing that, because it is a large issue with the number of people continuing to come into the state that have a lot more disposable income than most people in Idaho do, and housing prices continuing to grow. I think that's going to be a big issue.
Well, we only have a couple minutes left, but one question I want to ask is, you know, politics have gotten more polarizing in recent years. As an incumbent, you're probably feeling that yourself. Do you see ways to find common ground among your constituents? And how do you go about representing constituents that may have different ideas or viewpoints from you?
This question came up a month or so ago at a different forum, and I tried to make this a hallmark of my representation, knowing that even though there's many people that don't vote for me, I still represent them. And it's important to me to hear what they have to say and to have that discussion. I enjoy having a discussion about ideas. I know I don't hold all truth or have all knowledge, so there's things that I might miss that I want to hear, even from people that are on the different side of the political spectrum than I am. I try and hold a town hall every month when session is going. And the second term, that was when Indivisible was rising up nationally, and we had a group here in Sandpoint, and the town hall got pretty interesting, where you'd have maybe 20 or 30 people. We then had 70, and many of them had signs and were mad, but we had a good conversation, and some of them left thanking me, mm-hmm. because understanding what their perspective is, understanding the breadth of an issue, not just my perspective on it, but having that discussion is important, I think. And that goes with both sides. There's some folks that are maybe further to the right of me that don't, again, what I was mentioning earlier, don't think I'm voting correctly or something and are coming against me from that side, but still having that discussion. I hope constituents are willing to do that, not just cast aspersions and walk away, but to truly talk about issues. And I take some pride in that. I think I've been able to uphold that and have a good relationship with folks across the spectrum and trying to represent this district well.
Last question here. What differentiates you as a candidate? Why should people vote for you, Sage Dixon?
What I just mentioned, I think, mm-hmm. is one large differentiation. Mm-hmm. And I'm not trying to disparage my opponent in any way, but I think that's a differentiation between myself and a lot of other representatives in that sense, that I want to do the best policy possible for everybody, always upholding my principles and values that I state. But working hard for this district also, knowing there are different needs, and I've been thankful to do that. We had some grants available when I was on the education committee, and I helped Clark Fork get an innovative school grant so they could keep going. They were kind of on the edge of maybe having to shut down Clark Fork High School out there, and helping them get those dollars and create a new program, and now I think they're doing great out there. And things for Boundary County, out in the west of the county with Priest Lake and fixing the thoroughfare and the dam and out there. And those are important things that are always important to me. And especially when a constituent brings something to me, trying to get that work done for them. We have a young man who's blind that wants to still hunt. And a lot of states allow blind hunters to use an electronic device, mm-hmm. where somebody can guide them remotely. Mm-hmm. And we don't allow that. So this is something that I'm working with Fish and Game on now. Hopefully they'll pass a rule, but if not, then we'll do legislation, because mm-hmm. it makes sense. And I would have not known about that had not someone called me. And those are important things to me to keep working on. I think that's important for any representative.
Mm-hmm. Well, Sage Dixon, our incumbent representative, House Seat B, how can people who want to learn more about you find out more about you?
Well, sagedixon.com. It has issue statements. It has endorsements that I've been gathering for this race, and talks about some of the things that are important to me and a little bit more about my life. I take phone calls. If they want to call the number that's listed, it's 610-4800. Mm-hmm. And again, I'm happy to sit down and talk with people about things. And I have a voting record. You can always go look that up. And I'm sure there's some press out there. Mm-hmm. Want to be lazy or just go on Google, though we can read a little bit more about what I've done.
Okay, well, Sage Dixon, again, thank you for taking time to talk with us.
Thanks, Chris. It's always a pleasure.